From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. On Writer's Talk, we discuss writing with writers, find out what motivates them, what they think makes great writing, and why writing matters now more than ever. Today's guest is Sue Miller, and she's interviewed by Ohio State University student Anna Dorian.
My name is Anna Dorian, and we're speaking today with Sue Miller, author of The Senator's Wife, and While I Was Gone.
My name is Sue Miller. I'm the author of The Senator's Wife and six, I think, other novels and a collection of short stories and a memoir about my father.
Awesome. Can you tell me a little bit more about the work you've been doing here at OSU?
I've been sort of running a writing workshop in a pretty standard way, I think. It's a mixture of fiction and nonfiction, and it's a mixture of the years of students. Some are first-year students in the program, and some are second-year students in the program. And it's been a lot of fun. I'm teaching undergraduates in a general way at Smith now, and it reminds me of the differences of the pleasures of teaching graduate students. I think there are distinct pleasures to teaching undergraduates, too, but it's nice to be with graduate students for a while.
So have you done workshops like this before where you're running it?
Short-term workshops? Mm-hmm. Yeah, every now and then. I tend more either not to be teaching at all or to be teaching, you know, a semester long or several years or something someplace. But mm-hmm. every now and then I've done a sort of week-long master class or, you know, a short stint at some place.
Now, have you had your work workshopped with other writers as well?
A long time ago. I don't do that anymore. I don't listen to other people, so there's no point in my participating in such a thing.
Mm-hmm. What do you like about working, interacting with students in an academic setting?
Well, you know, I think it helps me sort of to think about fiction in a kind of technical way. And I get excited if they're good and there are things I can help them with. I enjoy that. But I think for myself, it helps me to sort of ponder it, you know, the issues that are raised, you know, why something isn't good is an interesting question. When it's pretty good but it's not really good is an interesting question to ask. What makes the difference? How do you get from there to there? That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So when you work with the MFA students, those are students who are studying to be writers, professional writers. Mm-hmm. Now, do you have words of advice for them in as to entering into that kind of a professional realm?
My advice always to writers is that they just should be reading all the time, all the time. I don't know that there is much advice for the sort of career part of it that's very helpful to anyone, especially now. I mean, I think the notion of writing as a career is a difficult one at this particular moment, and they just have to love doing it, essentially. But I think the thing that, you know, I would say my own apprenticeship was comprised largely of reading very intensively and intensely, and reading like a writer, as Francine Prose's book has it. I mean, sort of asking yourself always, you know, why am I feeling this way as I read this page? What are the words on the page that are making me have a certain kind of response to it? How's he doing it, in other words, or how's she doing it? And to me, those were, for me, the most helpful learning experiences about writing that I had.
What do you read now?
I read mostly fiction. I do like the memoir as a form, but I like biography, and I also like to read letters.
That's obvious in a lot of your works. There's always letters element.
People sneaking around reading other people's letters or letters left over from dead people and so forth. But I find letters, there are a lot of letters in my family that were sort of left over and were very helpful to me in sort of imagining and conjuring the past in a general way as well as in particular ways about my family. But I read a lot of fiction, and I try to sort of keep up. It's very hard with truly contemporary fiction. I don't do a great job at that. But I read a lot of people that I've liked to read for a while, like, you know, Ian McEwan or Alice Munro. Those are people whose work I wait for and I'm always eager to get when new books come out.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that when you read these letters, and you said you've included letters in your fiction as well as in your nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like they are a way of capturing a part of life that just documenting a situation isn't going to. You get a very specific point of view. how do you think the letters, your family's letters and your family influences, what part does your family, what role do they play in affecting your writing?
Oh, well, I think, you know, they were absolutely central in a lot of ways, although I have siblings who are not writers, so they weren't, it wasn't, you know, predictive, whatever they did. But they were people who were very concerned with words and language. My mother had written poetry, and she was a very witty person, much, much more quick and clever than I am, you know, a person who could make puns and that sort of thing. My father was a scholar. He was an ordained minister. He taught church history in the theological school at the University of Chicago. He himself wrote 5 or 6 books. They were, well, there were several that were very accessible to a sort of lay audience, as it were. Some were pretty technical, yeah. Really very historic. I think, you know, I just grew up in a house that was full of books. I grew up with a father who was incessantly writing. I mean, mm-hmm. he was at his desk all day. And with a mother who was passionately interested in books and had written poetry. And then after we were sort of all gone, when she was in her late 50s and early, well, until she died. She died at 60, but in the last year or so of her life, she was again writing poetry, and I think was very hopeful that she might get some published. She'd won a prize and that sort of thing. So they were people who used language carefully, who thought of language as being able to move people, to stir people, to educate people, to change people, to record emotion. And so I think I grew up just thinking that language had all of those powers. And I think some of this too was that my family was very religious. They weren't rigid. It was fun to grow up in my family. But we went to church every Sunday. And even when I was a little child, I went and heard the sermon, sat through the service. And, you know, really, I think the first sort of formal, the first form I apprehended kind of the written word, which a sermon is. I mean, they speak it, but they're essentially reading it, was the form of the sermon. So there was I sort of had an awareness that just arrived because I was sitting there listening week after week of the shape the sermon would take. I would be able to know, oh, now he's about to do that, and then he's going to, yeah, now here he comes, okay. He's doing that, and now he's going to bless us all, and off we go to behave better this week than we did last. But I think I understood that words could have certain sort of forms, the arrangements of words could have certain forms very early on. And also, we did Sunday school and we studied scripture, and scripture is really wonderful in the sense that it teaches you that language functions on several levels. There's a level of the parable, you know, the upper level of the parable, and then the spiritual level that it's really also talking about. So I think, and that's what essentially I think what fiction does, is it tells a story, but it's a story that's meant to be working at two levels, really. It's meant to entertain you, to draw you in, and then it's also meant to do something to you, I think.
Yeah, I think it could definitely be appreciated and useful on a secular level, where you're mm-hmm. taking, you know, what you learned from the scriptures, the structure of the scriptures, you know, and putting it into your fiction writing. Now, when did you said you did this all at a very young age. When did you think you wanted to be a writer?
I didn't think of it that way. I mean, I just wrote. I always wrote. I wrote as a little girl, stories and poetry. I won a high school National Scholastic Writing Award. I didn't write very much in college. I didn't have time to, but I did take one. And they didn't have very many writing courses when I was in college, but there was one at my college, and I did take it my senior year. But then just, you know, wrote all the time after that, once I'd graduated from college, without thinking of it as a career or without, you know, I think I probably thought I would do it the way my mother had done it. She always wrote. And that I would have to find a way to make a living that would be quite separate from that. And it wasn't really until I was in my mid-30s that I began to think, as I was reading things, my stuff is as good as this stuff, and maybe I could actually publish something. So I didn't send anything out until I was in my, I would say maybe 36, 37, when I sent out my first story to be taken.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's certainly difficult to make it in this profession. And I think from what I've heard, it's getting harder just because of the amount of competition in terms of the internet and internet writing?
Yes, I think the publishing industry is having a really hard time. And I think the economy will affect it too, but it was having a hard time before then. The number of people who, you know, read more than a book a year is not enormous in this country as a percentage of the population. So
it will be interesting to see the direction that that media form goes in the next probably 10 years. I mean, they already have digital books, but you have to get people to adapt to that as well. Mm-hmm. So people are often slow to change. Your memoir is your only nonfiction book.
That's right.
Do you see any other nonfiction in your future?
I don't know. I mean, I feel as though I, you know, I might try something again, but I have no idea what it would be. So I can't, without that, I can't really begin, can I? But I liked doing it in a certain way. It was very hard for me because I'd not done it before, and I worked on it over about 8 years. I mean, I would stop and turn back to fiction and then come back to it again. And, you know, it was a difficult form for me to be working in. I didn't know. I needed to be in the memoir as the narrator of it, as a person in it, and I was simply not used to being myself as a narrator. I was always a fictional person as a narrator, and I didn't know how far forward to step, how much to sort of tell about myself. That sort of thing was hard, and then it involved a lot of research, too. It's a book that is partially an explanation of what goes on in the brain when someone has Alzheimer's disease. But I liked it in the sense that I was learning the form, and that I was learning a great deal about the illness. And in thinking about it in connection with my father, I was sort of learning a great deal about my own responses to the illness, that sort of thing. So I might try to do something again, but I have no idea what.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I liked about the memoir is that, and this was early 80s, that you're talking about your father getting progressively sicker, is that it wasn't as understood or accepted at the time. And I really like your take on the way healthcare was dealing with it and the way you as an individual had to deal with his struggle. I think that it's great to kind of get a personal understanding of the things that families go through when a member of their family is struck with that. And I've had experience, but I was very young. And even now the experience has changed because of the types of treatments and medications. So it's always refreshing to hear that other people go through the same things, and that you're not alone to some extent, where you're not the one with the illness, but certainly it takes a toll on everyone.
Yes.
Now, as you were saying, it's difficult to write a memoir because you don't get to have the fun where you get to play with your characters, because your characters have already created themselves. How do you write about some of the people that you love the most in the most honest way that you can?
Well, it probably helped that these people were dead.
It's hard to offend them, I guess, at that point.
Yeah. But there were plenty of people still alive who knew them. I mean, I had aunts and uncles who of whom I was very aware. And, of course, my own siblings' response was something that I was interested in. And I hoped I would not offend them. But I just really did try to be as honest as I could. But to speak of the difficulties I had with them as my difficulties. I mean, my mother was for me, a very, very difficult person, and a very dramatic person, and a sort of hyper-dramatic. And, you know, I sort of tried to describe her and to talk about the way I responded to those things, rather than to sort of, I think, excoriate her for being that way, really talk about my difficulties with her at various times. And, you know, my father, I wrote about some things which arose as a result of his disease. I mean, anger that I felt at him, and fear at one point that I felt when he was really sort of threatening me. But it seems to me that it's a kind of tribute to both of them to be honest about them. So
I agree.
Yeah, I didn't feel hesitant about it at all.
Like I said, I was a small child, but it is it's a strange perspective, you know, to hear I had a grandmother, and, you know, to hear grandma cuss, because she had never sworn before, but, you know, and it's a different frustration that, you know, you realize that they're human, your parents are human and fallible as well. We talk about Charles Fry a lot in our classes, and if you don't want to talk about this, you don't have to, but it's been a hot topic in the literary, you know, in our classrooms and stuff, is how do you react to something that is put out, that is issued as a memoir, but obviously ends up containing, you know, fictitious situations mm-hmm. and events as a writer.
I think it's a real betrayal of the reader's trust, fundamentally. But, you know, there is, of course, some, I mean, one uses fictional techniques and you know, creates, I tried certainly to create scene, to dramatize the events that my father went through or that I went through. And certainly I was not always probably writing down the exact words that got spoken, that kind of thing. But, you know, I think I acknowledged in the memoir also that, you know, that I was, it was a test of my memory and I wouldn't be able to remember everything entirely accurately and other people might remember things differently. But it seems to me the effort has to be there and maybe the apology should be there too, but not to make the effort and to deliberately include things which you know are not so and which change the nature of the thing seems to me to be a fundamental. It's a lie. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's simply that, it's that simple.
Right, and you, especially when you can't market it as a memoir. You can go ahead and change that to fiction and, you know, see how many you can sell then. But how do you gain a reader's trust?
You mean in terms of writing a mm-hmm. memoir? Or,
yes.
Or
I would suppose in nonfiction. I mean, I guess they need to believe you in a mm-hmm. fiction. They need to believe that the scene is possible, mm-hmm. certainly in your type of fiction, where mm-hmm. it is, you know, real humans in real time.
Well, I think certainly in the memoir that I wrote, I sort of spent some time at the beginning of it discussing what for me were the issues of memory. And, of course, the book was itself about memory in a certain way and the failure of memory. So it opened itself and it was logical to really talk about that as an issue. And I suppose, in a way, that might have been a method of gaining the reader's trust, which is to address the issue directly at the very start of the book, to say, this is my book, this is the way I remember it. And near the start, I also sort of said, you know, but was it this way? You know, what were there really these things? Was the chair blue? That sort of thing. And to suggest to the reader my fallibility,
right.
But also that I was struggling to try to record it as accurately as I could.
Right, because it certainly is your experience. Like you said, you rewrite the scene to be as accurate as possible. But, you know, whether a chair is blue or not hopefully doesn't change, you know, doesn't change the purpose of your writing. What role did you play in the making of the movies based on your novels?
Really a minimal role, although I saw the screenplay for the first one, which was made from The Good Mother, and they were asking if I had some suggestions, and I had some suggestions, and they never sent me anything again. But my son and I were extras on the set one day, which was pleasurable. He was then 18, and I thought he would enjoy it. And the producer had asked me if that was something I might be interested in. So he and I went down, and we were in a sort of crowd scene. And the second one, I didn't at all. I saw the screenplay and saw that they had changed it a great deal. And I just sort of thought, okay, well, I'm staying away from this. But I actually didn't. Beyond that, didn't have any role whatsoever in them and didn't see them either because I just felt I didn't want to, that I wanted to hold on to the way that I sort of always had thought of them in my own mind, hold on to those images that were my own creation. It was very easy to see the day that we were on set how collaborative filmmaking is and how, you know, how each actor takes possession of the role in a certain way, alters it, makes it different. You know, so they were saying things differently from the way I had heard them in my own mind when I wrote them. They were even saying words that I didn't write. And I realized I really wasn't interested to have the experience of that sort of disjuncture. So I just didn't go to them.
Well, and I think when you take on those changes, it actually becomes a whole nother, you know, a whole nother work. And so I
agree. Yeah, I think, you know, what... And, you know, friends said that they thought the first one was very true. The Good Mother was very, very true to the book, which is fine. I was in we still had tapes of films that you went to the store to rent. And I was in such a store and somebody said, oh, there's a Good Mother. We could get that. And the other girl, there were two girls, said, it's a real bummer. So
and you don't want to take that personally because that's the movie and not the book.
Right. But, you know, I also think that there was a way in which the book, although it had the same events, was not a bummer. I mean, I think the book, there was something you can do with language around an event that you can't do with just presenting the event. And so that was interesting to me, actually, and funny.
You should have stepped in. I heard the book's much better.
So I was curious when you were talking about the future of reading and how people are not using books as much. I can never imagine myself reading with one of these Kindles, one of these downloading electronic books, although I love to read things as soon as they come out. I mean, I like to be on the library list or pre-order on Amazon for certain people, but to imagine myself sitting with a device mm-hmm. and not physically turning the page.
No, I agree. I mean, I think the book is perfect for what we want to do. And you can flip back and forward so easily if you want to
exactly.
Check to be sure that you read that preview,
exactly.
that thing, which suddenly seems different. But I've been sort of homeless for a while because we're having a renovation done on our house.
My.
And we've been lugging around these boxes of books
uh-huh.
that I need or that I want to read. And I sort of can see in that one instance, the great utility of it and the sense it might make if you were going on a vacation or something like that and you didn't want to have, one whole suitcase full of...
Paying by the pound.
Yeah, full of books. But for me, that really would be the only, I think, situation in which I would prefer that perhaps over the... But I haven't ever really tried to read. And I have a great deal of trouble even reading... student story, I always print them out.
Yes.
I never work with them on the screen. And in my own work, I always print it out and
it
then
has
do
to be
revision
on, the paper.
On paper. Yeah, I don't do revision typing anything in.
Uh-huh.
So I think I may eventually get one for traveling. I mean, because
uh-huh.
I think that would be very useful. But I'd like to try it first just to see if I really can do it. I'm not sure I really would... I mean, I might just prefer not to read.
And I know that the words are the same, but something about the experience doesn't seem...
No, it's quite different, I think, yeah.
You said that through your childhood, your father was, always at the top of the stairs and the door open and he was writing. What were his reading habits? And did you talk about books? Did you read when you were adults?
He read, I think, mostly... He was very widely read in a sort of 19th century way. I mean, he had read, all of Dickens, and he knew some of it 20th century. He knew T.S. Eliot. He knew, he knew a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But during the time that we were children and growing up, I think he was an academic, and he read mostly history and worked on his books and fundamentally was taken up with that and didn't really read contemporary fiction, I don't think. My mother did, to some degree. I think she was probably depressed a lot of our childhood, and so she spent a lot of time reading mysteries, which were a way to sort of escape, I think. But she did read more than some contemporary literature. But the books we had in the house were the books that they had read as undergraduates we just had a big collection of sort of classic literature. We had Bronte and Dickens and, but mostly 19th century, Austen. You could just go and we had some that were, my father actually read some to us, like The Swiss Family Robinson, that were for young people, or Lorna Doone, or... So we had, a lot of those books, and I'd read a lot of them not in any orderly way, not with any sense of where their place was in literary history, but just because they were on my parents' shelves. And I would pick something up, and if it seemed to pull me in, I would read it. So that was sort of the way I read, but they had a big library, but of a certain kind.
Your mother wrote poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Did she have to? I mean, was she compelled to write that for herself, or do you think she did have a dream of publication?
She did. She didn't. She didn't work very hard on her own poetry when we were growing up. She did. What she did was sort of this. She would write very witty things for sort of parties, or they would be sort of Ogden Nashy sort of flicks of the wrist. And she was very, very good at that. But she also was a lyric poet and had written in college and a little bit afterwards. And then, as I say, later in her life, actually in the few years before her death, she was writing again. And she was, we actually self-published for family a little collection. I edited it after she died. I sort of had all of her papers and went through, and there was some of them that were finished and some that were not, and I sort of normalized the punctuation and arranged them and so forth.
Oh,
and
nice.
Wrote a little essay beforehand, and my father paid to have it all printed up, and so we could give it to everybody. So she had quite a few. She had a small, it was a little chapbook that we made of her work. So she had quite a few things that were quite polished, I think,
uh-huh.
and nice. Yeah,
very cool. What is it about writing that you enjoy the most?
I think it's actually, well, first of all, I'm fundamentally a solitary person. I mean, I'm gregarious enough and I like people, but I really like my own company a lot. So I like doing something that doesn't, I mean, I like to come out it sort of as I am doing this week and be with people, but I like to do that and then not.
Yeah.
And so the solitariness of it appeals to me. The sort of invention part really appeals to me. I think that the period of time before I'm writing is one of the most deeply pleasurable to me. When I'm making notes, when I'm figuring out how this is going to go and what it's going to be and who the people are, I mean, what they're going to be like. And the actual, words are more work and sometimes are pleasurable when you sort of feel you've done it right. But a lot of the time, that's more of a struggle. And it's harder. The book is always the most fun before it's written, when it's sort of the ideal that you have and you haven't started to compromise it by actually writing words down on the page.
Mm-hmm. I'm also a solitary person, and I think I've heard that from other writers as well, that they love human nature, but certainly find that they find them a lot of enjoyment away from that kind of environment as well, because that's where they can focus on individual characteristics and what they want to put down on paper.
Mm-hmm.
What are you working on right now?
I have a book that was due in at Knopf in September. So I'm really, really struggling to try to finish it within a couple of months anyway. I mean, we were sort of locked out of our house and rented a place up in Vermont for a month just before this. And I just worked, long, long hours every day on it. And I think I'm within sight of the ending. So
good. Well, we're looking forward to that, certainly, especially here in Columbus. I know all of our MFAs and graduate professors have been very excited to have you here this week.
Oh, thanks.
I overheard them at the coffee house as well as, on the ride home, just how exciting it is to have, I guess you would say, professionals here to kind of work with and get opinions from and reflect on, mm-hmm. and aspire to be for some of them. So I was very excited to have you here in Columbus this weekend. I know you had a lot of events and it was very busy, but we really appreciate it.
Pleasure, really.
Is there anything you need to do in Columbus before you leave still? I'm trying to think what you have to do in Columbus before you go.
This is it, except for the class.
Except for the class?
Yeah, and then I just leave directly from the class to the airport, so it's all tightly scheduled.
Okay. Well, thank you very much again for being here, and I hope to see your newest work soon.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Writers Talk thanks the Thurber House for bringing Sue Miller to town as a guest speaker. For more Writers Talk, visit writerstalk.org. Or you can join us this Saturday, November 21st, at the first Writers Talk fundraiser at Cafe Kerouac at 8 p.m. We'll feature writers from past and future Writers Talk shows and have all manner of literary madness with our partners, the Ohio Anna Library and the Thurber House. You can also watch Writers Talk on the Ohio Channel on Fridays and CEAC Government Channel on Mondays. Stick around for more great programming from WCRS, which airs Democracy Now!, Free Speech Radio News, and other syndicated public affairs programs, in addition to locally made music, talk, and public affairs programs just like Writers Talk in English, French, Somali, and Spanish. Until next time, this is Doug Dangler from The Ohio State University saying, keep writing.